You know what's weird about coronavirus? It's like you can see the economic crisis coming. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday today, 6 March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I know this is the second week in a row that I'm doing this, but so much to talk about, so very little time, so we are going to get right to it. What the heck happened this week? Gina Smiley covers the Fed for the New York Times. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Sudeep, let me start with you and test my premise, would you, that you can kind of see the economic crisis kind of around the corner here?
You can see the signs of it, and it's not just financial markets that are screaming it. You see what's happening with canceled flights, with furloughed workers around the world, with conferences being shut down. All of the signs of a slow motion panic are forming here. And you know it's just a matter of time, but economic data takes weeks or months. And so we just are going to lose our minds in the meantime trying to figure out how bad it's going to get or whether we can get out of it without it getting into a true crisis beyond what we have now.
Yeah, no, for sure. We will get to jobs, by the way, later in the broadcast with Mitchell Hartman. I am not forgetting those for those of you who are keyed on the jobs report. But Gina, let me ask you this. So the Federal Reserve comes out this week with an intermeeting rate cut, right? It cuts rates half of a percentage point, and Jay Powell comes out and does a 10-15 minute press conference. He talks about how he and other central bankers are working to support the global economy as need be. How come nobody feels supported and calmed?
Okay, so I think I have to come to the Fed's defense here in the sense that they got a lot of flack for markets going down that day, despite the fact that they sort of, you know, brought out the bazooka. They did a 50 basis point rate cut for the first time since the 2008 financial crisis. But if you look back on history, when the Fed makes an emergency rate cut, and it's because there is something fundamental wrong with the economy, which I think you can make a pretty solid case is what we're seeing now, it is often the case that that is not enough to stop the market tumble that is already happening. And it seems like that may be what happened this week. You know, the Fed is not a panacea. It can, its policy cannot do everything. Yep. And there's a chance that a 50 basis point rate cut, you know, is not going to be enough to offset shattered supply chains and furloughed workers and a real shock to consumer confidence that might be coming down the line from this coronavirus.
Yeah, no, totally agree. And we should say here that the Fed is probably going to cut again when it meets on the 17th and 18th. And I wasn't criticizing the Fed. My question was, how come nobody feels better with all these big, important people saying nice things without Sudeep Reddy, it has to be said, the president of the United States doing anything positive, right? He is an economic headwind right now.
If you just ignore the words coming out of the president, what is the Fed really supposed to do? It doesn't have data. It knows something is going to be bad. It doesn't know if this is like 1998 when in the emerging markets crisis when it cut rates, or whether it's the spring of 2008 when it knew that disaster was coming, but just the scale was unknown. Look, the Federal Open Market Committee needs to release a statement urging all Americans to wash their hands for 20 seconds and not touch their faces. That's the solution to this problem. And obviously, they're going to go through a lot of debate about buying bonds. How long do you take this to zero? What is this going to do? And that is all just to cushion the economy in the small way that the Fed can. And as central bankers drone on and on in their speeches, they've been doing it for decades. Monetary policy works with a long and variable lag. Whatever they're doing now is only going to cushion something down the road. It is not going to rescue us in this moment.
Gina, let me get you back to something you said a minute ago about the fundamental flaw in the economy right now. I wonder if that might be a little premature, right? Because what we have so far, and granted, this week has been kind of a tipping point, I think, but what we have had is a supply shock, right? We haven't yet had the demand shock. We haven't yet had markets seize up. But as consumers stop buying because they're not going out, as companies stop getting revenue because consumers aren't buying and their earnings fall, then, my theory goes, it starts to become a whole different kind of crisis.
Absolutely the case. It is certainly true that we have not seen this pullback in the United States yet in any measurable kind of way. I do think, however, that this is like watching a storm roll in when you're sitting on your back porch. You know, we can look at the Asian data and see what is coming for us if this coronavirus epidemic turns into an epidemic, if this outbreak turns into an epidemic. Right. You know, China's factory data look terrible. They look worse than economists expected them to. If you look at real-time indicators like coal usage, which is kind of a proxy for electricity usage in China, it's still depressed. Traffic levels are way down. Pollution levels are way down. You know, everything across the board is just screaming that Chinese activity is kind of ground to this halt. And I think that it's pretty predictable at this point that other economies are going to experience similar things as we see this virus spread and as we see similar measures being taken to avert its spread in a lot of other economies. And so this is one of those instances where it's not happening yet, but we kind of know parts of it are going to happen.
Sudeep, go ahead.
But to Gina's point, the challenge here is that we don't know exactly where we'll end up. The range of possible outcomes is immense here. We could have, this could be a short-term situation. We have excellent public health officials, if they're allowed to do their jobs without interference, can probably figure out some way to get this calmer here than it's been in other countries. But we don't know if this is going to be a short thing that's a few weeks or a few months, or something longer where, you know, on those movies where an outbreak happens and that little red dot turns into a giant red dot on a country, and it looks like that. We just don't know. And that is so difficult for people to deal with in the Federal Reserve and other policymaking bodies, obviously in markets, and that is the fear and uncertainty that we've talked about for years that is gripping everybody right now.
Sudeep Reddy at Politico, Gina Smilek at the New York Times at the end of the second week, really, of the big impact of this coronavirus. Thanks, you two. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, well, it has been a week, hasn't it? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As promised, to jobs now. I think we remind you every now and then that the monthly unemployment report, which came out this morning, is what's known as a lagging indicator. It tells us what happened last month. Specifically, if you want to get all technical about it, and clearly I do, what was happening in what's called the reference week, the week of the month that contains the 12th. Or, to frame that a different way, what was happening in February before coronavirus became an economic thing. A thing, though, it now is. So what do we do with today's good news that looks backwards if we're trying to figure out the future? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is on the prognostication desk.
I asked two economists what today's report, 273,000 new jobs in February, unemployment falling to 3.5%, means to them.
Really the last waltz of strong and robust monthly hiring.
What a great report it was. But what does it mean for the future? Nothing, right?
That's Joseph Bruzuelas at RSM Consulting and Betsy Stevenson at the University of Michigan. Stevenson says this is a snapshot of the job market right before major supply and demand shocks from the novel coronavirus hit, disrupting trade, travel, and financial markets in the U.S. And she says we might not know how much this is impacting businesses and consumers from the next jobs report either.
Employment data is a lagging indicator. It's one of the last things we see. When we see those jobs reports starting to tell us a bad story, we're in the thick of it. The economy's already in trouble.
Bruzuelas says a sharp downturn in some economic activity is already evident.
I'm calling this the tip of the spear, the shipping and containers data. A number of weeks ago, the volume of shipping began to slow, in some cases double digits.
Bruzuelas says that'll likely show up first in weak hiring, or possibly layoffs, in transportation, wholesale and retail trade, manufacturing. And an early warning sign of that, he says, would be a sharp increase in weekly jobless claims. That could indicate that the unemployment rate is about to head higher. John Lear at Morning Consult surveys consumers every week. He says people are still feeling secure in their jobs, but when they're asked
to project 12 months into the future, whether or not they think they'll be doing better or worse financially than they are today. And that indicator took a pretty strong drop last week.
It's stabilized this week, and he says he's monitoring it closely because high consumer confidence and robust consumer spending are crucial to sustaining the economic expansion. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
are, fair warning here, going to dip a toe in the bond market weeds right now in the form of what are called real yields. Remember, the yield is the annual interest rate that a bond pays. For the benchmark 10-year Treasury note today, it was a stunningly low 0.78% at the close, and that wasn't even the intraday low. But hey, at least it's still positive, right? Well, no, because inflation, which means those real yields, have actually gone negative. Marketplace's Amy Scott explains what that might mean for the world's biggest economy.
When you factor in inflation, investors are actually losing money by lending to the U.S. government. The real yield on the 10-year T-note is about negative 0.5%. Why would anybody do that?
People are willing to pay up for that safety.
Carissa McDonough is chief fixed income strategist with People's United Advisors.
They're effectively giving up, you know, future sources of real yield to park their money to be safe today.
This has happened here before during the European debt crisis in 2012 and 13. Robin Brooks is chief economist at the Institute of International Finance, an industry trade group. He says investors are anticipating the Fed will likely need to cut rates even further to cushion the blow from the coronavirus.
If real rates are negative the way that they are now, it's sort of a realization that, holy cow, perhaps the Fed will be at zero for a very long time.
And the fear that's driving investors into bonds could slow growth even more.
That means that money that would have flowed into financing projects or money that would have gone into investments, it's currently hiding in treasuries. That's harmful for the economy because basically investment could be weaker, and so that can hurt growth going forward.
Just this week, the Institute downgraded its growth forecast for the United States from 2% to 1.3% annually because of the virus. Marilyn Cohen is CEO of Envision Capital Management, a bond portfolio manager. She says while some investors stick to safety, she worries others will start chasing higher yields.
You can buy dividend-paying stocks or real estate investment trusts. Well, those are very different instruments. They act very differently. Yes, their yields are higher than bonds.
But she says the risks are higher, too. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You can't produce a major Hollywood film, a blockbuster film, without having the China market as part of your strategy.
Even Hollywood isn't immune to the coronavirus. But first, let's do the numbers. See, I don't know if I'd have gone with the Wawa's today, right? I mean, it was only 0.9% on the Dow. Dow Industrial's down 256 today, 0.9%, 25,864. Although, to be fair, Mr. McHenry, it was down about 900 points at one point. The NASDAQ off 162 points, 1.8%, 85.75. The S&P 500 gave away 51 points, 1.7%, 29.72. There for the week, actually, the Dow managed to gain, added 1.7% to the blue chips. NASDAQ was up less than a 10%, S&P 500 up about a 0.5%. Oil prices tumbled to multi-year lows today after OPEC and Russia did not reach a deal on more production cuts aimed at countering a collapse in global demand. Scott Tong was telling us about that yesterday. West Texas Intermediate, that's the U.S. benchmark, down 10%. International benchmark Brent crude slid more than 9% today. Bonds already did that, actually. Bonds prices up. Yield on the 10-year T-note, 0.78%. You're listening to Marketplace. With Super Tuesday on our minds, we wanted to give you a super deal that you are not going to want to miss. Donate $30 today to get your hands on our brand new Marketplace t-shirt just for super fans like you. Your support is critical to what we do, and right now we need you more than ever. Become a Marketplace investor and cast your vote for the independent journalism that we do. Give today at Marketplace.org, and thanks.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Tempting though it may be, we simply cannot condone the behavior in this next interview. Slapping some ransomware on your boss's computer and exacting your revenge accordingly. All right, that's a dramatization, but interesting to consider, no? Drake Bennett's a staff writer for Bloomberg Businessweek who did a little ransomware experiment, yes, on his boss's computer, and all it took was a little patience and about $150 worth of Bitcoin. Drake, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So how did you, great idea. How'd you come up with it?
Well, the original idea was to do a bit more of a traditional story about ransomware attacks, which you've been seeing an increasing number of. But as I started to do the reporting, one thing I learned is that it's a very secretive world. There's a lot of misinformation out there. It's hard to really find out a lot and to be able to trust a lot of what you find. So I began to think maybe the way to do this is to just like try to do it myself. Then I can sort of double check what works and what doesn't, how easy it is to get your hands on this stuff and use it. It also had the added benefit of proving this point, which is that it's become incredibly easy to launch these attacks. And I am someone who's extraordinarily technologically illiterate. Right. And so if I could do it, anyone can do it.
Right. So with the caveat here that you talked to Bloomberg's lawyers and your boss was in on it and you used safe laptops and all of this stuff so that nobody actually got infected or whatever, it was distressing to me how easy it was for you, a relative noob, to go on the dark web and get yourself some ransomware software.
Yes. I mean, part of what's going on here is the same thing that happens in a lot of industries where you have technology sort of replaces skill. Hmm. And so you now can go on these dark web forums, find not only software, so software being like literally a piece of ransomware, which would be a piece of software that once it gets on a target computer will encrypt all the files there so that you, the attacker, can then demand a ransom to decrypt the files and give a company or a person all of their data back. You can also now get something else, which is called ransomware as a service, RAS.
Right.
Which is literally you pay a subscription fee and someone basically helps you do all this for you. And so it sort of lowers the bar even further.
Without exposing my naivete here, isn't that like a felony?
Well, you mean what I did?
Well, no. I mean, in theory, you did it with permissions and with lawyers. But ransomware as a service, I mean, that's like a crime.
Yes. I mean, you know, it is a crime in the United States to commit a ransomware attack. Now, most of the attackers that are launching these attacks are not in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so these guys aren't particularly afraid of being prosecuted.
Did you have any interaction beyond just purchasing the software on the dark web with, I guess you'd call them vendors, right?
Yes, vendors, service providers, actually. Mine was more of a service provider, and I did. I reached out through encrypted email service to the service providers at first, and then the service I got was not particularly top shelf, and so I had to then get back in touch with tech support, essentially. And so that's part of the service, right? There's support for me, the client, and then there's also a kind of a support for the victim, which ironically sometimes are referred to as clients also.
Wait, explain that. Support for them? Help me out. I guess they have to unlock it somehow, right?
Partly it's because Bitcoin is much more mainstream than it was, say, 5 or 6 years ago. Yeah. But it's still something that, you know, I, for example, had not ever bought or sold or sent anyone Bitcoin before I started doing this story. And a lot of people are like me. And so what attackers often do is offer to help with that process,
wow,
right? They're trying to make this as frictionless as possible. And one of the friction points is still people are not super comfortable with cryptocurrencies.
That's crazy. So what we have here, in effect, are the kidnappers saying, here, let me tell you how to arrange the payment for this thing of yours that we are holding hostage.
That's right. Let me help make this go as quickly and painlessly as possible. And, you know, one cybersecurity analyst I talked to sent me this document that some attackers had sent their victims after the ransom was paid. And it was basically this list of, like, cyber best practices that they could use to avoid getting attacked again in the future, kind of as like a bonus extra after paying off the attackers.
Drake Bennett writing in Bloomberg Business Week about ransomware as a service. Kind of a crazy article. Drake, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
The economic damage the coronavirus has done and is doing kind of depends a bit on what industry you're talking about, right? As Sudeep was mentioning, airlines and conferences, yes, for sure. Housing and mortgages, it's been a boost so far thanks to falling interest rates. Movies, a big, big negative. The latest Bond movie, as I'm sure you've heard, has been delayed worldwide until this fall. In China, the world's second biggest movie market, by the way, it's all been shut down. Theaters, production, everything. And the Chinese premiere of Disney's live-action Mulan is on hold indefinitely, though it is still set to debut here later this month. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst has more now on how a virus that started in China is affecting Hollywood.
Your job is to bring honor to the family.
With its star cast and storyline based on a Chinese legend, Disney's Mulan was supposed to make a big splash in that country. And for Hollywood, making a big splash in China is key. Professor Stanley Rosen teaches at the University of Southern California.
You can't produce a major Hollywood film, a blockbuster film, without having the China market as part of your strategy. And in many cases, like the Fast and Furious films or some of the Transformers films, the China market can be bigger.
Just last year, Chinese box office revenue was over $9 billion. The U.S. movie industry made more than $11 billion. Now, around 70,000 big screens in China have gone dark due to the epidemic. Rosen says some movies have hit streaming platforms instead of theaters, but big budget films won't make as much money that way.
So for those kinds of films, streaming is not really a solution. But for smaller budget films, certainly streaming makes a lot of sense.
Another big hit to Hollywood, the coronavirus has brought film production in China to a screeching halt. Sky Canavas is a contributing editor at China Film Insider.
Hollywood is increasingly turned to China over recent years.
There's a cap on how many foreign films can be shown annually in China. It's around 34. Chinese co-productions are one way Hollywood gets around that restriction. For example,
DreamWorks established Shanghai DreamWorks as a studio in China,
which led to films like the Kung Fu Panda franchise. Anne Kokas, author of the book Hollywood Made in China, says she's looking out for how Chinese investments in the film industry could be affected.
We're seeing an increase in Chinese firms investing in Hollywood studio production. So, for example, Tencent and Alibaba both have film investment arms that are increasingly active in the U.S. market.
Kokas expects to see Chinese government pressure investors to look inward.
After the pass of the coronavirus crisis, whenever that is, I think what we'll see is a retrenchment of domestic investment in China.
And as the virus spreads worldwide and possibly into the summer blockbuster season, there is the risk that more American movies will get delayed beyond China. Producers for the Bond movies said they pushed back the release because the global theatrical marketplace was uncertain. American box office revenues are up so far this year compared to 2019. Last month's Invisible Man beat expectations, but that was before there were runs on hand sanitizer. Will Americans keep going to the movies? The answer might come from some blue teenage elves.
For one whole day, Dad will be back!
What? Back? Like back to life? That's not possible.
Pixar's Onward, the story of two adolescent elves, premieres this weekend nationwide. Industry experts say whether people stay home this weekend, as the number of infected grow in Florida, California, and Washington, will tell us a lot about where Hollywood is heading during the epidemic. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which the Federal Reserve, which, as you know, has been pulling monetary policy levers all week. Gina Smilek was talking about that at the top of the broadcast. It now has ventured into health policy. Seriously. Reuters reports that the Fed is quarantining hard currency U.S. dollars that get repatriated from Asia. It's the regional Fed banks that actually handle the physical money supply. Bills coming back home are quarantined for 7 to 10 days. We should be clear here. The money in your wallet is almost certainly fine. The CDC says it may be possible to transmit coronavirus through objects that have had direct contact with it. But person-to-person contact is, of course, the main way that virus gets transmitted. So, wash your hands, sneeze into your elbow, don't touch your face. Let's be smart out there, people, huh? All right, we're out of here. Dow Industrial's down 256 today, 0.9%. The NASDAQ down 162 points, 1.8%. The S&P 500 gave away 51 points, 1.7% there. The key word, the buzzword, the byword, take your pick of this week, volatility. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Deborah Clark is the Senior Vice President and General Manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.